It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The hot new trend in the entertainment industry lately is not new at all. In fact, it's old. It's already been done before. Recent successful movies, video games, and even music trends have focused on nostalgia and bringing us back to the stories, genres, and ideas we already knew and loved before. Critics over the years have argued that nostalgia can keep us stuck in the past, trying to relive a time that's no longer as relevant to the present or our future. But hang on. Our next guest is a psychologist who's done a lot of research on nostalgia. In his new book, he says nostalgia can help bring us forward, not hold us back. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find nostalgia and feelings of the past maybe holding you back? Or do they make you more hopeful for a better future? Do you like to watch or rewatch movies, shows, or stories that remind you of an earlier time? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Clay Rutledge is the Vice President of Research and Director of the Human Flourishing Lab, the Archbridge Institute, a nonprofit public policy think tank in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the new book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. Clay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
We might all have a basic idea of nostalgia and what it means. Give us a quick working definition for our conversation.
So the basic definition of nostalgia that you'd find, like if you looked in an online dictionary, is something like nostalgia is a sentimental or wistful longing for the past. When we've studied it, really what you can think of nostalgia is, it is a feeling, it is an emotion, but it's also our memories, it's our cherished memories. So it's that feeling we have when we reflect back on memories that for various reasons we find fulfilling or meaningful.
The idea, the word I learned from your book is a few hundred years old, and for most of that time, it was thought of as a bad thing by scientists, researchers, doctors, the early days of the psychology profession. Why was it viewed so, it seems like consistently, negatively for so long?
Yeah, that's right. In 1688, the term was coined really to represent a medical, what they thought of was a medical disease of Swiss mercenaries fighting wars far from home. And they thought of it as a disease because when these soldiers were longing for home, they were experiencing all sorts of physical symptoms, insomnia, vomiting, fever, you know, all sorts of distressing symptoms. And so they thought, oh, like this longing for home is causing them a great deal of suffering and misery. And that idea really persisted for a long time. Eventually, it fell out of favor in the medical community. But with the rise of psychology, you started to see psychologists think of nostalgia as some kind of mental disease or mental disorder. And really that persisted, as you noted, until a few decades ago when researchers started to really disentangle cause from effect. And what I mean by that is what people used to think is, oh, you're looking back on these memories or you're longing for a home and that's making you miserable. But what we've started to realize with modern behavioral science is a lot of times what's going on is you're feeling miserable and that's making you return to these memories, which might actually be helping you deal with that misery. So that was really a more recent discovery.
And you mentioned researchers, that includes you, and you write that you entered into the field at a time when there weren't many people really doing research. I mean, there are theories about nostalgia. You were part of a group around the world, really, that started trying to put it into practice and talk to people and do research into how they feel nostalgia. What led you down that path?
Yeah, that was actually really surprising to me is when I first started to thinking about this, really, I was more interested actually in how people think about the future. So one thing that's kind of cool about being a human is like we can imagine a future and that helps us plan for the future and really advance civilization in a lot of ways and improve our own lives. But thinking about the future also causes anxiety because it's uncertain and the one certainty isn't great, which is our mortality. And so when we think about the future, we get excited, we get hopeful, but we also get a little bit anxious and uncertain. And so what I thought was maybe what happens is we use that same mental time travel ability that allows us to think about the future to turn backwards and look to the past for comfort. And I thought, okay, well, this is going to be well known. This is going to be well established in the scientific literature. And then what I discovered is actually there wasn't a lot of work on this. There was work in marketing on how people like to spend money on products that remind them of the past, but there really wasn't much work on the the psychological mechanics of nostalgia, minus this historical account that we've talked about, where there was a lot of theorizing about nostalgia as a medical disease or as a psychological disorder, but there really wasn't a lot of like high quality research studies on this topic.
Talking to Clay Rutledge, psychologist, author of the new book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. You could join in with your experiences, your questions about nostalgia at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Clay, if I had a number one takeaway from your book, it seems like it's this paradox. We might think of nostalgia as sort of retreating in the into the past, maybe being stuck there. But you say no. That's actually a path toward planning for the future. How does that work?
You know, when I first started studying nostalgia, I would have been in that camp of people that said, well, nostalgia is about holding us back. Or, you know, to be more generous, I would have thought, well, nostalgia might comfort us, but it really doesn't help us move forward, except to the extent that it's good to be comforted. But then, you know, what I discovered, not just me, but other researchers as well, is that when people engage in nostalgic reflection, not only are they looking backwards to comfort for themselves, but they're actually looking for ideas and for inspiration to solve problems in the present. So just spend some time with entrepreneurs who are, you know, trying to create a product that improves their community. And you'll find a lot of them have a nostalgic story that inspired them. They have some memory from their childhood or youth that really motivated them to do what they do today. Artists are the same. If you listen to music, if you watch movies, if you read books, all those creators have the stories, the nostalgic stories that inspired them to do the thing that they do. And we started to study that more empirically as well. And what we found is that when you have people spend a few minutes reflecting on a nostalgic memory, subsequently, they feel more inspired. They feel more motivated. They're more creative. They're more interested in going out and meeting people. They're more open-minded. So really what we find is engaging in nostalgic reflection actually pushes people towards the types of thoughts and emotions and goals that advance their lives, and also kind of advance communities and societies more broadly.
I want to dig into one example you share that really stood out to me. A fellow named William Dunn had nostalgic memories of fishing with his dad, right? And that's one of those bittersweet things. He enjoyed it. He couldn't do it again. Tell us what he did with that nostalgia, what it inspired him to do for the present and future.
Yeah, well, you know, like you said, he had these memories from his past, and there was this bittersweet, you know, which is actually fairly common with nostalgic memories. But then there was another child in this community when he was an adult that was going through a difficult time, and this was like take a kid fishing, and he took this kid fishing, and he just started this as this kind of personal individual project, and it really, you know, this kid started getting better grades, started having a better relationship with his mom, and really started improving his life. And this kid didn't have his own father to take him fishing, and so that kind of gave him the idea that you could scale this this project, right? There's all sorts of kids that need mentors and adults in their lives to help them. And so that's where he started ended up starting this nonprofit organization, which was rooted, as you noted, in his own childhood memories of going fishing with his father.
Something that really strikes me about this is this idea of, I don't think you say it in exactly this way, we could engage with our nostalgia in a passive way, like, oh, that was a great time, I really miss it, whatever. Or we can kind of talk to it and say, what is it? What was the value there? How can I recreate that value, even if I can't recreate that exact circumstance, that exact activity? Talk about engaging with our nostalgia to figure out ways to recreate that feeling, if not the actual event.
Yeah, that was really the reason that I wrote the book, is because, you know, at some level, nostalgia is natural. We just do it organically. And what I mean by that is, you know, we all have these experiences where we hear an old song and it takes us back and we like that. And it just kind of happens in our lives, or we just start to, we're talking to an old friend and we start sharing old memories, and you know, that's just part of life. But I thought if that's something that has the potential to be good for us, then just like exercise is good for us, and we can, you know, we can improve exercise by getting a personal trainer or going to the gym or really learning better form and better technique, I thought, well, maybe there's something to more intentionally engaging in nostalgia in a way that can help us extract the greatest benefits out of it. And, you know, the, going down that path, what I discovered was the more action oriented it is, the more engaging and the more social the nostalgic experience, I think the better it is for us. So it's great to listen to it's great to watch old shows and listen to old music and all of that. But it's even better if you can channel that into a hobby, learn to play guitar, you know, cook old family recipes, start a book club, or, you know, engage in the types of activities that allow you not just to yourself benefit from those memories, but to do things for other people and to share those memories with other people. And it actually doesn't, it kind of comes naturally. It helps to really push it, but it comes naturally too, because it turns out when people engage in nostalgia, they don't want to keep it to themselves. They want to share it. Look at the Barbie movie phenomenon that happened, mm-hmm. you know, last year, which like people had all these, particularly women had all these memories about Barbie, and they didn't just want to go to the movie by themselves. They wanted to get their girlfriends together and go out and make it a big like social activity, make it a social media sort of phenomenon. And I think that happens a lot. Like we're really, really inspired not just to keep these nostalgic experiences to ourselves, but to connect with others over them.
We're talking to psychologist Clay Rutledge about nostalgia and his new book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What triggers nostalgic feelings for you? A person, a place, a thing, a song, a moment in your, I don't know, high school years or your 20s? Does it make you feel good? A little bit sad that it's gone? Does it lead to good things for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Clay Rutledge. He's an existential psychologist who's with us today to talk about nostalgia and his new book. It's called Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What comes to mind when you think of nostalgia? Is there a moment in your life, a memory, person, a song, you name it, that makes you feel nostalgic? What questions do you have for our expert, our researcher on nostalgia and what it does for us? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Clay, you have a chapter on nostalgia and loneliness. And I found this really interesting. You'd think if somebody's feeling lonely, and many people are in the United States these days, and they think back to a time where they didn't feel lonely, you might think they'd feel worse. I had that and I lost it. But it doesn't necessarily have to work that way. How can that end up being a positive?
Yeah, so one thing that happens with loneliness, which makes it such a difficult social problem that we face, is loneliness leads to more loneliness. When people feel lonely, they tend to withdraw from others even further as a way to avoid further social harm. The last thing someone who feels socially disconnected wants to experience is further rejection or ostracism. So what happens when people engage in nostalgia is first thing it does is it kind of takes them out of that moment and helps them see a bigger picture that, yeah, right now things aren't going great in my social life and I'm experiencing social pain, but my life is bigger than this. And in the past, I've actually had meaningful social experiences, rewarding social experiences. So if I've had them in the past, then I could probably have them again in the future. So I think that's one big part of it, is just taking that kind of perspective, that bigger picture. But in addition to that, nostalgia also helps you recruit the kind of mental resources you need to resolve loneliness. So when you feel lonely, you lack confidence. You feel like you would have a hard time making friends or reestablishing old relationships or repairing relationships. Nostalgic memories tend to boost social confidence. And so that might give you just that extra push you need to take the risk and to call to, you know, to reach out to somebody you haven't talked to in a long time or somebody that you've been having problems with, or, you know, to go out and to forge new relationships. And so nostalgia is a great way to kind of pull you out of a rut and re-energize your social life.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hey, Rob. So if the three of us went out and did something tomorrow, And then we all looked back on it in a year from now and wanted to repeat that. Time has passed and people grow, they evolve. And so we can't go back to what it was, even if the three of us got together and went and did some activity. So nostalgia, I think, to me, it's just it's the fond memories. And I think really what it comes down to in life is to just do it like the Nike slogan says, just go for it and build those fond memories. Because, of course, today there's always going to be, you know, more opportunities and stuff coming our way. You know, you just have to be positive and, you know, see the brighter side of things.
Interesting, Mark. Thanks a lot for the call. So Mark saying, I think, Clay, let's make good moments today to have things to feel nostalgic about in the future and use that nostalgia to keep us moving forward in the same way.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that that's actually how this often works is people don't really want to exactly repeat something most of the time. It is the fond memories that kind of push us forward. And we think, well, I can create new memories but we want that connection often. We want to feel like, you know, our new memories and somehow are related to our ongoing life story, our ongoing life narrative. And so, yeah, collecting these memories over time helps us, it kind of inspires us to create new memories. We do this all the time when we plan vacations. We even engage in almost like an anticipatory nostalgia where we're plotting ahead of what we want to do on that to create memories, knowing that, you know, we will have those memories with us even long after the vacation.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Talking to Clay Rutledge, psychologist, author of the new book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. You use the words a life story and life narrative, Clay. That reminds me of another example of kind of how we use nostalgia to tell our stories. You talk about someone in the book who thinks back on a birthday party when they were a kid. They invited lots of people to the party. Only a few showed up. Oh, no, that's a bad, sad memory. But the few who showed up had a ton of fun. That's a good memory and maybe a lesson. Can you talk about how we sort and narrate our stories to get the best out of our nostalgia?
Yeah, I'm guessing most people have an experience in which they've rewatched a movie many years from the first time they watched it. And they're like, oh, I'm learning new. I didn't pick this up. I was too young to get that message from the movie or to pick up on that particular theme. Our own life story is kind of like that. We have all sorts of experiences. And as we get older and we've had the opportunity to grow, to mature, we can look back and say, you know, at the time that was really difficult because at the time I was really concerned about social, you know, being popular. But now as I've gotten older and I realize like being popular is not the most important thing. It's actually more important to have like a few deep, enduring, like, you know, really high quality relationships. Mm-hmm. Then I can look back on that experience and say, oh, wow, okay, there was a lesson there. And I think that's actually one of the really neat things about nostalgia is that we can, at different points in life, we can pull from these memories when we're ready to really learn from them and extract new information from them, really useful information that helps us continue to grow.
Let's go back to our callers with Laura in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi, what did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, hi. I'm going on 73 years old, and I find myself lately, I just recently purchased an old-fashioned vacuum coffee pot that my mother used to use. I bought the coffee that she used to use, a certain brand, and I've been making recipes that she used to make, like Bohemian American recipes, and I find such comfort in it. It's interesting.
Laura, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And Clay, Laura hitting a big point of your book, a lot of our nostalgia, most, maybe all of our nostalgia in many ways, is about our social connections, our connections with other people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, in nearly all of the work that's been done on nostalgia, the most common like theme that comes out is nostalgia is really about relationships. Even memories that seem like they're very much about your own like experience, your own triumphs, it doesn't take long to interrogate them to figure out that you're really thinking about the people that motivated you, that inspired you, the people that helped you, the people that you wanted to be proud of you. I mean, so most of these memories are about relationships. In addition to that, the example that was just provided is a great one because we often like to use aesthetics, you know, to create environments, to populate like where we live with things that help us remind us of those memories. And so when people think about consumer nostalgia, they think of it as being, you know, oftentimes it's portrayed as being fairly superficial. You know, you just buying consumer products that remind you of the past. But in reality, those products are often symbols that help that cue up connection points. Like the example just provided, like a certain coffee pot might remind you, might bring you back to memories with your mom. And so even the material objects that we create or put in our environment to feel nostalgic for are often really about relationships.
Thanks for that call. Clay, I want to see if you can help people out. I can think of a bunch of songs, you know, the good old days, glory days, things like that, where the good times were, or whatever, high school era, early 20s, and they're gone and we can't come back to them. If somebody's stuck in that kind of nostalgia trap, if you will, can you offer some advice to turn that around and get some inspiration from nostalgia?
Yeah, I think a very good exercise to engage in if you feel like for some reason that the past was better than the present and you're getting stuck in this nostalgia trap is to get more specific and to ask yourself, well, what are the particular aspects of the or features of the past that you think were better and why? And then ask yourself, would you really give up a lot of the advances that have been made? And do you really want to return to the past? And when you get it more surgical like that, it ends up being better because people can extract, okay, there is something about the past. Maybe when I was young, I felt freer. I felt more open-minded. I felt more energetic. And I don't want to go back to that period of time, but if I can capture the essence of that feeling and that can help me feel that way again, that can help me take on new challenges, it can help me find the confidence and openness to explore new ideas and new approaches, then I can maybe channel that nostalgic energy into the present. You're never going to be, you know, you're never going to be 18 again, but you can capture some of that psychology of being 18 that you found inspiring.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
That's Clay Rutledge, Vice President of Research, Director of the Human Flourishing Lab at the Archbridge Institute, psychologist, author of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, lawmakers in the Wisconsin Assembly passed a bipartisan bill that would require political candidates and groups to be transparent about using AI technology in their advertisements. In particular, this would involve generative artificial intelligence used to create audio and video of people saying stuff that they never did. An expert on AI ethics will join us in a couple to talk about the past, present, and future consequences of AI in elections. First, we'll talk to one of the co-authors of Assembly Bill 664 about the contents and progress of the bill. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about these artificially generated videos, pieces of audio that might portray a candidate saying something that they never said? Have you encountered it yourself? What kind of regulations would you want to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Clinton Anderson is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 45th Assembly District. That includes portions of Green and Rock County. Representative Anderson, thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate having this conversation.
Can you spell out this bill a little further? What would it do to regulate the use of artificially generated images, video, and audio in an election campaign?
So this bill would require a disclaimer on anything substantially generated by artificial intelligence when it comes to political ads with audio and video. So this is something that we've kind of talked about with a bipartisan group of legislators for several months. We're coming up to the 2024 election cycle, and we were a little worried about the advancement of AI in elections, so we thought, let's do something together.
What were some of the specific concerns that led you and your colleagues to tackle this issue?
Really, it's transparency. We've seen some of the ads in the national news about using AI. And we, for example, one of the DeSantis super PACs used a AI-generated voice of Donald Trump bashing Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. And while he did write those things, it was misleading. We want to make sure that we have transparency in our elections. And that's something that both sides of the aisle have come to an agreement on.
I understand the penalty for violating this law, if it's passed, would be a $1,000 fine. Is that per ad or per message or per caller who received that message, which could multiply it a lot?
Yeah, it's per violation. That is for the disclaimer being left off alone. And I know folks are really worried about the negative aspect of AI. So there is still a section of statute which could be litigated. It's 12.05. So if there is false statements in elections, there is a section of statute which could be litigated. It hasn't been yet, but with the advancement of AI, I think this would be a time that it could be.
Now, if I'm a political group and I'm raising thousands and thousands of dollars and I want to run something, you know, the day before Election Day, $1,000 doesn't sound so bad to me. Is this going to be enough to deter anything?
We think it's going to be enough to really have a conversation about, you know, if we need to go further. That was the conversation we had with our other authors was, let's see where this goes. We want something on the books now. We know that this might need changes in the future. We don't know what the 2024 election cycle looks like. And yeah, there are going to be bad actors, but that's, you know, if you're doing a horrible negative ad, there is Section 12105. So it's not just the penalty. It's going for the on the ethics side. It is about the negative ads, which is in the section of statute already.
Gotcha. And why a fine and not a ban on these AI generated false videos?
We didn't want this to get overturned in the middle of an election cycle. We thought that that might run into some First Amendment issues. So we decided that we would do a disclaimer model. And ours is unique because it's the only one in the country that would be content neutral. So it doesn't matter if it's a positive or negative ad. If you use AI, you have to disclose it. So we didn't want to have this be the Wild West in October of 2024.
As I mentioned, this has passed the Assembly, some bipartisan authorship and sponsorship and support here. What's the timeline now? What are your hopes for it to go through the Senate, which I think it has not done yet, to the governor and become law?
Yeah, my understanding is that it should be on the next Senate calendar. We'll obviously wait and see once it's official, but that is what I've been told. I am excited to see that pass the Senate and then go to the governor's desk and become law.
Representative Anderson, thanks again for joining us.
Yes, not a problem.
That's Representative Clinton Anderson, Democratic representative for Wisconsin's 45th Assembly District. That includes portions of Green and Rock counties. He joins us to talk about a Wisconsin bill that would require political candidates and groups to label ads that use AI technology. Now we'll talk to a Wisconsin expert on the ethics of artificial intelligence about the consequences of using AI in election contexts. Robin Zabrowski is a professor of cognitive science at Beloit College, where she chairs the cognitive science program and has a joint appointment in philosophy, psychology, and computer science. Robin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, something I've learned from talking to you in the past, Robin, is we should probably talk about what we mean when we're talking about AI. That covers a lot of ground. What's being covered in this law here seems to be a particular type, if I have this right, generative AI. Could you talk about what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so generative AI is sort of the current AI hype. So it's the art bots like DALL-E and the text generators, things like ChatGPT. These are the things that train on an enormous body of human-produced work and then mimic that work as their own output. So it's and of course, now we have the new video versions of this that was just teased by OpenAI recently.
So it starts with a prompt from a human. So I might say, hey, AI program, give me a couple lines in the voice of candidate A saying they hate puppies, right? And then that would generate some audio. I'd pick the best one that comes out of that, and then I could go make phone calls or to voters or ads with it.
That's right. Yes.
That anti-puppy message would be very harmful. Now, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on this proposed regulation? We were just talking to Representative Anderson about. Do you think this could help deter some of this behavior?
I love that people are finally looking to government regulation for some of this. The tech companies have shown time and again they won't police themselves. There has to be regulation. It has to be regulation with teeth. Like there has to be actual consequences for violating it. I'm really worried about that $1,000 fine bit. I know you asked about that, and I can see now why they made it kind of a weak consequence to be sure that the bill passes. But oof, there's a saying that if something, if the punishment for a crime is a fine, that just means the crime is legal for rich people. And in an election, you know, everyone that's involved in trying to do these sorts of influence campaigns is going to have the money to pay that fine.
Right. The argument might be, well, is there a First Amendment defense? Hey, generating an AI line in somebody's voice? It's a speech act. It's free speech. It's covered under the First Amendment. Do you worry that it would be tough to pass a law along those lines, actually stopping these things or having more strict punishments?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, there are already laws against like voter suppression and election disruption, but it's not obvious that those laws are at all prepared to deal with the kinds of disruptions we will see with generative AI, I think.
Now, this is a big election year, not just in the United States, but I think there's a record number of big elections happening in countries around the world. What are your worries about the use of this generative AI to create a false audio, maybe even false videos in this global election year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real problem is that once the damage is done, the damage is done. Once that lie is out there, trying to then take it back is extremely difficult. We know this with all kinds of disinformation. And there are some ways that, like, you don't even need the AI hype. It's an election year. Disinformation is happening in all different modalities, and that's bad. But AI makes it much easier to convince people who maybe think of themselves as already a little savvy, and so maybe don't have their guards up quite as much as they probably need to. And yeah, we're seeing it all over the world, right? I think it was India just had a big problem with basically a deep fake voice thing as well, I think. And their election was in fact interfered with, if I recall. And so everybody's scrambling, and it's not clear that we're scrambling early enough.
I saw, and I wish I could attribute this, but somebody made the point that, okay, social media gives us a very effective distribution channel for misinformation. AI is going to give us an amazingly efficient production channel for creating false information. Instead of, you know, needing a bunch of dudes in Macedonia or something doctoring up phony news stories, AI can really crank this out almost infinitely. How big a concern is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a real concern. I think in some ways we're overestimating some of the video stuff. Like, there are still a lot of tells. The video deepfakes aren't great, really. And so in some ways, like, I keep thinking back to the bigger disinfo campaigns that I've lived through. Like, I'm always remembering this, what were they, the Swift Voters for Truth or whatever it was. Like, the disinformation damage is going to be done. And yes, the generative AI is poised to do a good amount of damage. But the videos, especially if you look closely, like, I know there was a ton of hype just a day or two ago when OpenAI released their Sora demo. But if you look closely at that, you can actually see people with still too many fingers. And there was definitely a dog with three ears. And those were the things that they very carefully curated to release as their promos. So there are ways in which we're still looking at the tells that the generative AI has had since it went public. You know, count the teeth, count the fingers, and you're going to see some messiness that should help indicate.
Yeah, but if I looked at, like, text generated by AI like 3 or 4 years ago, it had all sorts of tells that made it pretty obvious this was not human created. It seems like a lot of ground has been made up there. And could video move as quickly?
I kind of hope not, but it's possible. the problem is there's going to be a hard cap on video, on any of it, really. Some of the ways that it works, it means that what it's doing is it's just taking every piece of its data set and it's saying, okay, you want to produce a dog that's running through the streets. I'm going to make my best guess as to what a dog is and what a street is. And there's a hard cap to that, right? Like, it doesn't know anything about anything. So it's not like it knows what a dog is. It just has a whole bunch of examples. And so there's probably going to be a hard cap on how good these things can get. The art bots that have been out for a year or so now, I don't think they've improved a ton.
Robin Zabrowski is with us from Beloit College. We're talking with her about generative artificial intelligence, how it might affect the future of our elections. Some artificially generated voice messages so far seem to be the biggest example already used in the U.S. in 2024. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or concerns you want to bring up about the use of this artificially generated content in elections? Do you want to see regulations from, say, the state government, as we just heard, fines for politicians or groups that use these kind of things without saying, hey, this is made up stuff? Do you want to see social media outlets do more to regulate this kind of content? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Robin Zabrowski, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. We're talking to her about the use of AI, especially generative AI in elections, how we might protect ourselves against generated political misinformation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this? Do you want to see somebody regulate the spread of this kind of information, things that might make it look like or sound like a politician said something that they never said, for example? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robin, big picture on artificial intelligence. Now, the stock market and other markets are booming today. This company, NVIDIA, just set a record for an increase in the market value. The things I'm reading are saying it's because of AI and their optimism about the future of making money from AI. Looks like industry is going full steam ahead. Is anybody regulating this? Who would you want to see regulating this to make sure we don't have more and more problems based on this rise?
Yeah, so I am skeptical that the AI hype train is going to go for much longer. I feel like everyone's talking about using it to do things, but like it seems to me that it's not actually providing actual value over the work that humans do in most cases. I think a lot of people are buying the hype that it will do that. And they're saying, oh, I can see now that if I fire all these humans and replace them with AI, I'm going to save a ton of money. And it's just not obvious to me that's all going to play out the way they think it is. So I guess we're going to, you know, maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I'm not convinced. But certainly there's got to be regulation for certain industries because in journalism, something that I'm sure affects you, journalism is laying people off left and right, but then they're becoming deeply embarrassed by the AI generated stories they're publishing because they're nonsense and filled with like incorrect facts of things.
Do you have more worries about misuse of the AI stuff we have so far than a positive use case for most of the things that are out there?
Almost certainly, yeah. Like, I keep thinking about it, and the longer I think about it, the less convinced I am that there is a very good reason for these tools to even be, like, out and about. We're seeing a ton of worker displacement for it. And I don't think that they can actually do the jobs that the people being replaced do. So I'm way more worried about sort of the misuse rather than the actual use, because I'm not sure yet what the actual use is going to turn out to be.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Oconomowoc. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you? You know, the last statement just made by your guest is exactly what I'm thinking, and I'm suggesting a really perhaps oversimplified solution. Upon the birth of each child and from time to time, we register that person's image and name as a national copyright, and somebody abuses it by creating this artificial circumstance. Don't just make it a small fine. Make it a criminal prosecution. I'm sorry if that's going to crowd our courts. I'm a lawyer. I'd like the business.
Tom, thanks for the call. So basically lifetime name, image, and likeness rights so that, say, artificial intelligence things can't scrub our data and use it for gain in the future. Robin, what do you think of the notion?
I kind of love it, to be honest. I really do think that part of the problem is that people don't recognize, like the people who believe that this is just going to keep getting better and better, don't recognize that the data sets that they're trained with already are, you know, they've been used up. And now the places that those data sets came from are being populated with AI generated stuff. And so it's not like real people are necessarily making new data to train these sets. And it just absolutely seems to me that they're going to hit a hard limit without people opting in. And I love the caller suggestion that you just say, no, this is my image, my everything, and you can't use it. I think that that would be fantastic.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Robin, I wanted to get your thoughts on social media platforms. Now, in the news lately, we've had AI-assisted things where it puts Taylor Swift's head on porn images. Basically, it's happened to other celebrities. Big questions about whether X, formerly Twitter, is doing much or anything to prevent this. I could see these fake political messages coming up on social media platforms. Do you see social media platform providers being part of the solution here and setting better guidelines and enforcement for these kind of artificially generated images or political disinformation?
Yeah, they absolutely should be doing more. And I know that when X was still Twitter, behind the scenes, they worked kind of endlessly to reduce all kinds of disinformation, not just in the US, but all over the world. And it's not crazy to think that X became X and was purchased in part to undo some of that, right? To loosen those regulations. So in addition to stronger government regulation, I think that those platforms have a huge responsibility to control some of that disinformation. And again, I don't think any of these tech companies, not the ones releasing the AI models or the social media platforms, they're not going to police themselves.
And I want to take a few minutes, Robin. When we're talking about AI, most of what we encounter in our daily lives seems to be this generative AI. You put in a prompt, it gives you the text or the image or the audio, maybe the video. What other realms of AI, artificial intelligence, do you have your eye on? It's something maybe we should be keeping an eye on, maybe thinking about regulating.
There is all kinds of stuff that's been in use now for quite a while that I think actually the generative AI, the best thing it's done so far is raise people's awareness. And I know that there are now more regulations in the works. The Justice Department, I think, is paying more attention. But there have been algorithms that have been sentencing people in courts for quite a while now, and they've been proprietary. So people can get a harsher sentence for the same crime, and when they ask why, they don't get an answer because the algorithms are not shared. And so I love that the Justice Department is finally starting to pay attention to all different instances of AI and not just this generative stuff.
How important is that issue of transparency when we have a black box in a recommendation algorithm or a sentencing algorithm or things like that, and nobody can necessarily explain why the output comes out? What kind of transparency would you like to see?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, certainly I don't think you should be able to be sentenced in a court and not see why you were sentenced. But it goes further than that, right? Like I teach my college students that they're stuck with like algorithms that are screening their resumes now at every job, and they don't know what the algorithms are or what they're looking for or why they may fail those passes. I think companies should have to disclose when they're using those tools. And that way people can know what is happening, because, you know, like that's their livelihood to get these jobs. And again, I think that there needs to be much, much greater widespread regulation of all of these kinds of technologies.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Robin Zabrowski, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. She chairs the cognitive science program there and has a joint appointment in philosophy, psychology, and computer science. We talked to her about how AI-generated content might impact elections this year and in the future, how we can protect our democracy as that technology continues to develop. Earlier, we talked to State Assembly Representative Clinton Anderson about legislation that would put a fine on political groups that run fake generated images and audio clips without disclosing that they're doing that. We're taking a big risk here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We are shrinking our winter member drive from 7 days to just one. That's next week. Why are we doing that? Because we know you value the WPR programs you listen to each and every day. We want to minimize the disruptions to your daily listening experience. But we can only pull it off with your help. We can get a big start right now when you give now at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate. Regular listeners may know that I'm a big fan of sweet treats. I'm always excited to see new Wisconsin twists on old favorites. There are two of them in the news this week. One, the Wisconsin State Fair is going to have two special flavors of their famous cream puffs, not at the State Fair in the summer, but for St. Patrick's Day. The flavors, mint chalk, not so much into mint in desserts lately, but the other one, Irish cream puffs. So shut up and take my money for that one. Item two, I saw this in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Cedar Crest Ice Cream had their annual 4-H flavor creation contest. 4-H clubs around the state submit their new flavor ideas. The winner, the Posobiec Pathfinders 4-H Club of Merrill, the creation Paul Bunyan Ice Cream. Quote, vanilla bean ice cream with double-dipped pretzel logs, maple syrup, and swirls of Butterfinger sawdust. Works for me. That should be out in July of this year. Good thing our Food Friday tomorrow is about salad. Sweet treat news you can use. This is Central Time.
Tailored or entertaining way.
Now, people ask you very personal and weighty questions, you know, whether to stay in a marriage, whether to have more kids, how to deal with dysfunctional family dynamics. The list goes on and on. Once you've gotten a question, you've decided this is what you're going to tackle. What's your method? How do you approach it?
Well, I'm just going to stop you for a second. When you list it that way, it sounds impossible. Like, what am I doing? somebody asking me if they should stay in their marriage. Pass. I don't know. but it's funny. Once you get into the mode, once you get into the answering mode, you just sort of you're immersed in it and you believe in it. And I think my method is to approach each question with suggestions for how to think, because I don't think it's necessarily appropriate. I mean, I was just joking about it, but I really don't think it's appropriate for me to say, wow, you got to get out of there. Right. Except in very extreme circumstances, which I do sometimes. But most of the time it's okay. Here's the situation you described to me. Here are the five things I would think about, or here's where I would start this process, or here are the small things that you can do to help you see if you can feel better that way with a very limited reach into your list of changes, and see if that helps. You know, so it's very measured, actually. I try to keep the writing I try to keep the writing loose, but the advice is very conservative, actually.
Carolyn Hax is with us. Carolyn's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for about 30 years, just about. You could join in with your questions about what it's like to be an advice columnist. If you read advice columns, Carolyn's or others, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Stephanie is with us in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hi there, Rob, and hi, Carolyn Hax. You are one of my favorite columnists. I just called to basically tell you that when I heard that there was going to be an advice columnist on on this show, I called to find out, and I'm like, oh, yay. No, you know, I really like the way you approach problems because, you know, you don't preach to people. You don't put yourself above people. Your advice is it's very intelligent. You know, you look at things that are, here's a situation. These are things you realistically can control or not control. But you're very thoughtful. And you've described keeping your advice conservative, except in like extreme situations and being, you know, looking at ways of thinking about the problem. And I really appreciate that a lot. I mean, I'm dealing with my own stuff right now, but we always are, you know, no matter what. I'm going to turn 74 at the end of this month, and I've been losing my vision and other things. But, you know, I mean, I personally really look, I find the advice columns, yours, Ask Amy, the Miss Manners column, I find them very helpful.
Stephanie, thank you so much. Carolyn, Stephanie, clearly, I imagine a lot of people like this find reading your advice columns, maybe others, helpful, even if it isn't their particular question that day.
I hope so. I mean, first of all, I want to say thank you. That was a lovely comment. I can't ask for a better reader. I really appreciate that. And I also, aside from the kind words, I feel really seen on sort of what I'm trying to get across. And so, and of course, you never know. I'm having a really one-sided conversation here. I'm just sort of banging away at my laptop. And I can't always know that what I intend is going to be received that way. And so to have somebody recognize that I'm not trying to make pronouncements from on high is really lovely to hear. But now I've forgotten the question you asked me.
you answered it. I think that people are getting okay. Something out of your column, even if it's, you know, yes. Even if Stephanie didn't write the question you answered that day. Yeah.
Right. Well, of course, yes. And there was, I did have an answer in mind for that. So that's why I wanted to circle back to it. but I think that when you were asking me earlier about my approach, and one of the things that I try to keep in mind is that there's always a second answer. So there's the primary answer that addresses the narrow topic that somebody has brought up. But to me, there's always a second answer, which associates that narrow issue with its context. And I think when you start bringing things into context and connecting it to other things, that's when you really start to address other people as well. And also, I think you get it more of the issue if you treat it in context instead of in isolation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Stephanie. We'll go to Fawn now in Madison. Fawn, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to, I'm kind of like the last column. I just wanted to say, oh no, why just when I got on the line, I started to sneeze.
That's the fear of live radio, that coughing fit, Fawn, but it's okay.
Okay, no, I really appreciate
it. I have this effect on people.
Oh, dear. No, I really appreciate your column. I like your approach and your fresh tone, your fresh voice, basically. Sounds. I guess that's what you were aiming for from the beginning. And that exactly, you do give advice that is really measured, and it seems to me sensible and sensitive at the same time. And you, with a well-rounded, you know, perspective. Rare have been the occasions I've disagreed with you, or occasionally I wanted to chime in and say, am this, or have you considered this? And I also like that you seem to crowdsource some of your, or you allow readers to chime in online, I suppose, and then, you know, put their two cents in, some of which you excerpt and publish also.
Fawn, thanks a lot for the call. I wanted to bring that up, Carolyn. There's some call and response there. You give your take, and often you'll share other readers' thoughts for the initial question asker.
Yeah, so that comes from a live online chat that I do. And I don't have anybody reading my answers before I post them. So this is truly live, even though I'm slow. I mean, it's sort of live in a tortoise-like kind of way. But there's no net. There's no you know, delay button to make sure I don't say something horrible. So one of the things that's so, I think, different about this chat is I get to have crowdsource corrections as I go, or my incomplete answer that I throw out there in 2 minutes gets completed by reader feedback. And so when we decided to, what the decision to include the adapted columns from these transcripts was part of a decision to go daily. And I said I didn't want to go daily with all new material plus the chats, because I said then I would be rushing. I want to be able to take my time. And so we did this combination of the three columns that original each week that I take my time with, and then we adapt the transcripts of the chats. And so I decided to preserve the format of my throwing out a possibly complete but more likely incomplete answer that gets completed by other observations. And I don't know, I enjoy it. I don't know if readers appreciate it. Sometimes I get people saying, like, I'm not reading your column to see what other people have to say. But then I also get criticism sometimes that, oh, you know, you never admit you're wrong. I'm like, I bring in other voices almost every column saying, well, I think that, you know, I think there's this perspective also. So I don't know. I think it rounds out what I'm trying to do. And again, which includes acknowledging that how I look at something is not the be all and end all. We're all different. We all come at the same problem in very different ways. And so having somebody else look at it, I think, adds something.
Vaughn, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about advice columns. Our guest is Carolyn Hacks, who's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for pretty near three decades now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to advice podcasts or read advice columns? Do you ever apply what you hear there to your own life? Have you ever written in a question to Carolyn or other advice columnists? Did you get good advice? Do you go way back with advice columns to where you would read them in a newspaper and maybe write back with your own take on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about advice columns, their popularity, what we can learn from them with person who writes one. Carolyn Hacks is with us. She writes an advice column at the Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for Carolyn about what it's like to write an advice column. If you are a fan of hers or other advice columns or nowadays podcasts or chats or you name it, love to hear your experience, what you like about it. 800-642-1234. Or if you have an old school favorite, the Dear Abbeys or Ann Landers's, join it at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I had a weird question about writing for an advice column, which was, do you ever get someone writing in asking you something where you just wonder, why are they asking me this? Who am I to answer this question? And also, I was curious, like, when you have something like that, like, I mean, I know you said that you wrote them more or less live, but is there a certain amount of fear that goes into giving the wrong advice?
Interesting, Nick. Carolyn?
Well, okay, so I'll answer the second one first. I spent a lot of time lying awake at night, especially when I first started doing this, because it is really presumptuous to just take a question that's maybe four paragraphs and say, okay, go do this with your life. I take that very seriously. And I think it's one of the reasons I developed the approach that I have now of just suggesting things for people to think about, because that takes my fingerprints off some things. It gets me out of people's business where I really don't belong. But I think the first part is, it reminds me a little bit of comedy where they say that the way to be funny is to just buy into the bit, just go all in. And I think the advice column is such a bizarre institution. I mean, it is a deeply bizarre institution when you think about it. And for example, I will get people following up with their questions, wondering why I haven't answered it yet. And I'm like, well, you haven't bought into the whole bit. I mean, this is a bunch of people, right? Basically, I think people are writing into the void. I don't think they realistically expect an answer, most of them. And I think it's just a way of just, it's like throwing coins in a fountain. And so what we're doing is more of a, instead of my speaking to somebody asking me a question, I think it's more of a collective experience of we're going to throw out these things that I think everybody thinks about a little bit, or that I'm really struggling with, and I think I don't necessarily want to talk about with my friends. And so I'm going to throw it out there and see if we can get, we can air this public analysis of this issue. And I think that's been borne out in my experience, because sometimes when I answer people, they write back and say, oh my gosh, I never expected that this would get answered. And I think that's actually a normal, that's a very normal way of approaching this.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marcus joins us next in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So my great uncle Don used to tell me, when it comes to advice, that I should keep a rake and a broom. And I said, are we doing yard work? He said, no. He said, keep a mental rake and a mental broom. Rake in that which is useful to you and broom the rest. Because it's our own personal responsibility to determine what's right for us. So I think that by providing the advice, people are asking for it, and some might be writing into the void, as you say, but other people might actually, you know, they're actually asking the question. And so, you know, it just provides food for thought, and it's not your responsibility what they, you know, it's their decision that they ultimately make to take the advice or not.
Marcus, thanks
I'm
a lot.
Oh,
good, Carolyn, yeah.
Okay, that's really useful. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to put it above my desk.
Thanks a lot.
I answered you. Now it's not my problem.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. But, and that makes me wonder, Carolyn, do you have advice for advice column readers about what to do with your advice or others, how to engage with it in a way that says, okay, yes, I like this. I'm going to question that. I'm going to discard that.
I think you just said it. I think anything we read, though, and I don't think it applies just to advice or my advice or columns or podcasts. I think everything we come across presents us with a filtering challenge. And I think it's a healthy way to approach things, where you take what serves you or what is true. Since we want to talk about the broader context, you don't just take the information that serves you best and throw away the rest. I think you look at the big picture for what is correct and what is fair and what is useful, and use those pieces. And I think the more that we can gather, the more effectively we can screen and gather the information coming at us, I think the more successful we can be just as people.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carolyn Hacks is with us. She writes an advice column at the Washington Post, talking about advice columns. Carolyn, some things in the old media, whatever you call them, haven't translated well to the internet or have been replaced by a lot of other things. Advice columns. Now, people do go on Reddit and try to crowdsource advice, or Quora or whatever. There's a long, long list. But there's clearly still a demand for you and other particular personalities to keep doing this advice column. Why? Why did that that element of our older media stick around and find such appeal online?
I can't say that I know. thank goodness it did. But I think the things that the itches that an advice column satisfies are still there. And I think first of all, I think the advice columns have always been successful based on the voice behind them. And so that's something that, that's something you get with a column, but you don't get with crowdsourcing. Although, again, we go back to the fact that I'm using other people, I'm picking up reader comments. I think actually there are some amazing thinkers and writers out there in my audience, and I love amplifying their voices. So, but I think that adds to what I'm doing, and it doesn't necessarily say, okay, crowdsourcing is a great alternative to a single voice column, because there's a familiar voice. And if you like the way somebody writes, or if you like the way somebody thinks, it's a familiar and welcoming place. And then the topic is so universal. I guess I'm talking about just being human. It's not, oh, I'm talking about climate or politics or decorating. I mean, this is how we live. This is how we interact with people, and it's endless. The amount of connections we can make to our own lives in one column that might have nothing to do with our lives in particular.
Well, speaking of your voice, we heard from Rit in Madison, who couldn't stay on the line. Rit says he's loved your columns for a long time, and his kids, Carolyn, his kids coined the phrase, quote, bringing down the hacks. And that refers to saying things with lots of sass. You're a legend now. You are in a phrase in Rit's family. How do you feel about that?
I, I wish he'd been able to stay on because I want to ask him, like, do they hate me?
I get the sense it's very positive. Yeah, I don't know. No, Ritz a fan, it sounds like. Carolyn, can you leave us in just our last, a little less than a minute now, with a bit of advice when we have that, you know, interpersonal friction in our lives, a starting point to step back and think things through, whether or not we write to an advice column?
Yes. Oh, my God. I think that the happiness is inversely proportional to the number of things you take personally. So if somebody does something awful, if you choose to recognize it as something as their thing and not speaking directly to you, it's very calming. It's just it's a wonderful release. Fewer arguments.
It's a great place to leave it. Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you again for having me.
Carolyn Hacks has been writing an advice column for the Washington Post for just about 3 decades. We listen back to our talk with her about how she approaches her work and what we can learn from advice columns. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, when Americans look at the economy, they see greed, lots and lots of greed. That's the finding in recent surveys. A Wisconsin researcher breaks down our views of money and finance. And salad is the star of the show on this week's edition of Food Friday. A cookbook author shares her favorite Hungry Lady salads with recipes and advice. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. And WPR's one-day member drive is coming up next week. We still need to raise the same amount of money as a regular drive. To get us on track to meet our target, we have a goal of 500 donors by February 28th. When we reach that goal, an additional $20,000 will be unlocked for the programs you value. You can give now at WPR.org/donate. Coming up, we can get bogged down by nostalgia, but a psychologist tells us it can be a force for good. Meet the author of the new book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.